challenge there in placing and unplacing those fields in the maximally efficient way. First of all, to pack in the fibres on the targets as efficiently as possible, given the constraints, which are that you can't put any two fibres closer than about 12 arc seconds, and that you can't bend the fibre from its home park position at the edge of the plate by more than 15 degrees from the radial direction. However, if a robot's able to actually do that positioning with about 7 seconds per fibre, which means that we can configure all 400, given the typical overhead that we've got to unpack a previous configuration before we can pack the next one. So we need to move about 550 fibres, typically on average, to place 400 in the focal plane. So that 7 seconds to position a given fibre, in fact, translates to 60 to 65 minutes to configure a new field, so that any observations which have exposure times of that length will have very little dead time, because we can be configuring one field and have it ready and then tumble it to the position as soon as the previous observation is finished. So that was the whole point, of course, of the tumbler mechanism, to reduce dead time in the survey. That's the absolute minimum, the effective typical minimum distance you can have, because of course it depends on the detailed geometry of the fibres itself. The effective separation is more like about 30 arc seconds. 12 arc seconds is the absolute bare minimum if you butt two prisms right up against each other. This is the actual robot positioning fibres in the field of view. In order for the robot to see where the fibres are, we actually backlight them with LEDs, so it actually images each fibre. It can then tell whether the fibre is down on the plate or not by whether the image is in focus, and it then can centroid up on that light source in order to precisely position the light source, the actual core of the fibre, where we need it on the plate. Here's a configuration actually in place. These are what the fibres look like on the plate. You can see each one has got a small right-angle prism here, which is, catches the light as it comes in and then sends it out along the fibre. And underneath here is a rare earth magnet, which is holding it to the plate. Okay, so the point of the survey, of course, was to go bigger. And the previous generation of surveys, things like the Las Campanas Redshift Survey and the IRAS Point Source Catalog Redshift Survey, were typically looking at a few tens of thousands of galaxies over volumes of order, you know, a few by 10 to the 6 cubic megaparsecs. And the idea was to improve on that by at least an order of magnitude in each parameter. So we're in fact looking at 250,000 galaxies over a bit over 10 to the 7 cubic megaparsecs. Of course, people are expanding on that even as we speak. The Sloan survey will be going to a million galaxies over a somewhat larger area, doing a quarter of the northern sky. And then things like the Deep 2 survey, or the survey on the VLT, the Vermos survey, will be going out to redshifts about 1 and doing surveys that are somewhere intermediate in size between Las Campanas and the 2DF survey. So there's been an enormous expansion both in the size and the volume and the depth to which redshift surveys can be carried out over the last decade or so. Our survey, of course, requires a large area of sky to be imaged. Unlike Sloan, we're not doing imaging for ourselves. We're actually relying on the pre-existing sky survey based on the photographic plate survey done with the UK Schmidt, and then scanning that in with laser densitometers like the APM Galaxy, the APM densitometer at Cambridge in the UK. This is the early version of that by Maddox et al. In 1990. This is a map of the density of galaxies down to about 20th magnitude over 4,500 square degrees. And there's about 2 million galaxies in that map. The little holes cut out of the map are positions of bright stars, satellite trails, or other plate flaws that have to be eliminated from the survey. We've in fact extended that considerably to cover not only a larger area in the south, but also a considerable area of the northern galactic hemisphere. Here's the original area of the survey overlaid on the fully surveyed region, which are the little red dashed squares here in the south, and another region in the north galactic cap, this of course being the galactic plane here, which we've ignored. The survey has two main regions. A region in the North Galactic Pole region, which is 75 degrees by 7.5 degrees and contains about 70,000 galaxies. A region about twice as wide but the same length in the South Galactic, centered on the South Galactic Pole with 140,000 galaxies. And then another 40,000 galaxies in random fields scattered around the entire low extinction region of the South Galactic Cap there, which again has about 40,000 galaxies in it. So in all, there's about 2,000 square degrees, and we're going down to an apparent magnitude limit of 19.45. And there are 250,000 galaxies in this survey volume. The total volume, if you just look at the strips, the contiguous area of the strips is about 3 by 10 to the 7 cubic megaparsecs. If you include the volume that's sparsely sampled by the random fields, that's pushing up towards 10 to the 8 cubic megaparsecs.
When you said you used the ATM survey, is it at the level of the galaxy catalog, or do you redo the identification?
We've actually redone the entire thing from scratch and in extending it, so that we had to completely redo the astrometry, because the original APM catalog only had astrometry good to about half an arc second or so, which was not good enough for our fiber positioning. So in fact, we've redone the entire thing from scratch. Redone the astrometry, redone the photometry, extended it considerably. So having said that, we didn't really do any imaging. In fact, we did a hell of a lot of work that felt like imaging. So this is what our survey region looks like relative to the galaxy. Of course, these regions extend out a little bit further than indicated there. But we're... that's just a bit of fun. The extinction maps that we're basing our selection of the regions on are, of course, the Schlegel et al. Maps. We used an original early release version of the maps and then updated them as they were revised. You can see the South Galactic Pole region, of course, here is in a very low extinction region, and the even the random fields are generally also in low extinction regions. In the north, of course, we didn't have as much choice because we couldn't push any closer to the North Galactic Pole. But nonetheless, we're still in a relatively low extinction region here as well. So the survey magnitude limit is reflected in this survey magnitude limit mask. These are the North Galactic Pole, the South Galactic Pole. You can see the regions cut out for stars and other problems on the plates. And you can also see that the plates actually have varying magnitude limits themselves. This is because that we selected the survey very early on. But then, of course, we revised the photometry as further information came in. We also had to revise the dust maps. And as a result, our individual plates and even local, even small regions within the survey turn out to have slightly different survey magnitude limits. So there is no single survey magnitude limit that applies universally across there. And we have to allow for this in our analysis. We would argue that, in fact, striving to get perfect uniformity in your selection is of actually rather little value. It costs you a lot of effort and gains you rather little. It's much better to deal with the inevitable variations in your sensitivity in an explicit fashion like this. Okay, so people often wonder whether the 2DF photometry is any good since it's based on photographic plates, which many people, of course, have never seen, let alone ever used these days. So it's worth pointing out that, in fact, in a comparison with the most recent Sloan data, we actually do very well indeed. Our photometry is isophotal photometry. We don't have total magnitudes, but we have isophotal magnitudes. So there's a slight offset between our magnitudes and those of the Sloan survey. Here we've got our magnitudes. Here we've got the difference between us and Sloan, where we've converted the Sloan magnitudes and colors to give us an approximation to our particular filter combination, the blue BJ filter. And you see that there's an offset of about 0.06 of a magnitude, with the Sloan being slightly brighter. And that's simply due to the fact that they're closer approximating a total magnitude than we are. They're going deeper down the isophotes than we are. If we take out that small offset, however, then we see that, in fact, there's very good agreement between our results and Sloan if we look at absolute magnitude, if we look at redshift, if we look at color. And the only place that we actually see a significant difference, which is precisely where you expect it, is in the surface brightness. Because of our isophotal limit and because they go deeper, there's this tendency for us to find that things with low central surface brightnesses are somewhat fainter than Sloan finds them. And that's simply the isophotal limit, and that's perfectly predictable based on the relative depths of the two imaging surveys. So in fact, there's very good agreement overall, and if you look at the residuals between us, you find that if you just look at the residuals as they stand, you get a typical RMS error of around about 0.16. That's the error in the difference, so the error in each of the individual surveys is somewhat smaller. And if you take out the surface brightness effect simply based on the prediction that you have given our relative isophotal limits, then you get an RMS residual of around about 0.12. So in fact, the 2DF photometry is very good. It compares extremely well to Sloan. And for all the things that we care about it for, this is well within the spec that's required. Okay, in order to look at 250,000 galaxies, you need a fully automated data pipeline, and we do have that. As we take the galaxies, we have this reduction software where we simply hit two buttons up there in the top right. You see setup, and you hit that once, and then you hit start, and then it just happily chews away at the data as it comes on in. And if you believe that, you'll believe anything. In fact, however, by the end of the survey, or indeed by a short way into the survey, we had it to the point where we not only reduced all the data immediately in real time, but we also measured redshifts in real time. So that in fact, by the time the next observation was finished, we'd completely reduced and got redshifts for the previous observation. So we were getting our redshifts out inside an hour in real time. And that's including full visual examination by at least one person of every single object in the survey. In fact, almost all the objects in the survey were visually examined twice and many several times, so that we're very confident in the results that we get. These are the sort of spectra that we're getting. This is just to show you the sort of quality of the data. Here's an absorption line redshift, emission line, so on and so forth. Okay, the redshift yield per field, median yield is around about 93% due to weather or bad conditions of one sort or another. About 10% of fields have yields less than 80%, but 70% of our fields have yields higher than 90%. Even the low yield ones, the ones that had yields below about 70%, we simply reobserved. And the ones in that intermediate regime, we usually didn't bother reobserving because due to our adaptive tiling system, where we're actually multiply observing most areas of the sky, one of the other overlapping fields was able to make up the difference so that our overall redshift completeness was quite high. Redshift reliability is extremely good. We've actually got 10,000 galaxies in common with the Sloan survey in the Northern Galactic's pole strip. Only 1% of those differ by what we consider a probable error amount, around 600 kilometres a second. And the redshift precision for the remaining ones is about 85 kilometres a second. That's the difference between us and Sloan. So the redshifts also are in extremely good agreement with Sloan. What they mostly seem to be, actually, is cases of close pairs of galaxies where we have identified and observed one object and Sloan's identified and observed the other one. And it's not clear whether we've simply misidentified objects or whether one or other of us has actually identified the same object but then placed the fibre on the second object. So it tends to be close pairs like that. I mean, there is also, of course, just a small residual of low signal-to-noise things where the redshift is wrong and it's not clear who's right. Okay, the survey observations were actually completed in April this year. And eventually, we ended up taking 272 nights on the AAT over 5 years. We only had just under 50% clear time, so we had miserable luck with the weather. In the end, however, we ended up measuring over 221,000 unique galaxy redshifts. We had many, many repeats amongst that set. In fact, we had a total of 270,000 spectra, so there's nearly 50,000 repeat observations there. On top of this, we also have 14,000 stars and about 180 QSOs that snuck in there somehow. This is the sky coverage of the survey. The red dots are the fields we actually observed. The blue dots were the fields that, well, actually, the blue dots are a slightly optimistic version of the things we actually intended to observe. The outermost rain here and there, and the lower one there, extras that we put in and didn't tell the time assignment committee about, but never got to observe anyway. So in fact, our sample is, as I said, 221,000 out of 250,000, so about 90% complete. The completeness mask, this shows you the map of how complete our redshifts are over the sky. This includes the effects of course, weather and repeat observing and so on. You can see where multiple observations occur, we're virtually 100% complete, but some fields are of lower completeness than others. And you can see the overall completeness up there in the top right. In fact, the completeness depends not only in position on the sky, which is effectively the overall completeness of a given field that we observe, And that simply depends on the weather at the time, the seeing, cloud cover, and so on. But it also depends on the apparent magnitude, as you might expect. It's harder to get a redshift for faint things than for bright things. So we fall off from near perfect completeness at bright magnitudes down to around 80% completeness at the faint limits of our survey. Now, in fact, that in turn depends on the overall field completeness. So in a field which has got low overall completeness, say it's only 80% complete across the whole field, the magnitude-dependent effect is stronger, the black line, whereas for a field that's nearly complete, the magnitude-dependent effect is weaker. So in fact, we allow for that when we're computing our completeness corrections. So we have completeness corrections as a function of position, overall completeness of the field, and apparent magnitude of the galaxy. This is the redshift distribution for the full survey. You can see that even though we're looking at a very large number of galaxies, there's still large-scale structure very readily apparent there. The median redshift of our survey is about 0.11, and there's virtually nothing out beyond a redshift of 0.3. That's just the apparent magnitude redshift distribution as well. So this is a plot of all 221,000 galaxies just slapped down on the sky, compressing everything down onto a single slice in RA, going out to a redshift of about 0.3. That's not terribly useful for looking at the data because it all just blurs out. There's too many dots on the diagram. A little bit better is to look at a diagram like this, which shows you the local density, likely smoothed, but that doesn't correct for the selection effect. In fact, the best way we've found to look at the data is by actually flying through it in a movie that we've made. There's now actually a 3D movie made for the 2DF Galaxy Redshift Survey, and in fact, we're just modifying that now, so in fact, it's a navigable 3D movie, so you can actually be Captain Kirk and fly your way through the survey. However, more usefully, perhaps, is simply to take a single 3-degree thick slice right through the survey. So this is a constant thickness slice. We're not taking out the selection function radially, but we are taking out the wedge shape of the original survey. I'm not going to show you the movie, but I can show it to you offline at some time or other. It's a bit of fun, but it's not serious. This 3-degree slice is much better at showing you the amount of structure that we see. We've got three slices like that in the south and about two like that in the north. So this is only showing you about a quarter of the entire survey. This slice shows you, first of all, the number of structures that we see, the voids we see. You can see that no single structures are dominating the whole thing, simple things like that. More interesting, however, is to slice even finer and do 1-degree slices and see how the structure actually varies from slice to slice. Here's a single slice, here's a neighboring slice, another one, and another one, and another. And that is the equivalent slice taken from the Sloan survey. So these two slices here and here are exactly the same volume of space from the two surveys. You can see there's a couple of differences. For one thing, of course, this is from the Sloan early data release, so there's some holes in their coverage at this point. That's not very significant. What's more interesting, however, is the fact that you can see that we're actually sampling more densely than they are. Our sampling, we actually go deeper down the luminosity function at these depths, and so we're actually getting more galaxies per unit volume than the Sloan survey. Another thing you can clearly see is that the structures here are sharper and better defined than they are here. And this is a result of the different selection effects. We're selecting in blue magnitudes, so we're looking at more star-forming, late-type galaxies. They're selecting in red magnitudes. They've got a preference towards bulge-dominated, early-type galaxies. And those galaxies tend to be found at the cores of the higher-density regions. They're more strongly biased. And I'll come back to that in detail later on. In fact, I'm now just going to give you a brief run over the highlights of the main results we've obtained from this data set, and then I'll go back over them in more detail. So what have we achieved so far? Well, precise determination of large-scale structure in the galaxy distribution up to scales of about 600 megaparsecs. We've also, which is kind of fun, although not very surprising, we've got an unambiguous detection of coherent collapse on large scales. So this is a direct confirmation that, in fact, if you ever doubted it, the large-scale structure actually grows by gravitational instability and not by magic of some other variety. We have a weak detection of acoustic oscillations in the distribution of galaxies due to baryon-photon coupling in the early universe. We can actually measure the mean mass density from both the power spectrum itself and from the redshift space distortions, and we get consistent answers around about omega of 0.3 with a 20% error bar. We get a measurement of the baryon fraction from the acoustic oscillations, and that's actually now just barely a 3 sigma detection, but more importantly, it's an independent confirmation of the numbers that you would get from, say, Big Bang baryosynthesis, nucleosynthesis. We also get the first ever measurement of the galaxy bias parameter, and for redshift 0 L star galaxies, that number is essentially unity to within the 8% errors that we've got. We also get a new and stronger upper limit on the neutrino fraction. We find that the total neutrino fraction can be no more than about 13% of the total mass density, and that in turn implies that the sum of the masses of all the neutrino species has to be less than about 1.8 electron volts. Okay, here's just a quick cosmology by eye thing to show you that all these numbers are not just appearing out of some black box machinery. You can really see the difference in cosmology. Here are 4 different models with 2 different cosmologies, lambda CDM and a standard CDM model, and 2 different biasing schemes at the top and the bottom. The details of the models don't really matter. The point trying to be made here is simply that one can tell the difference, one can see the difference between this observed slice of our redshift survey and these 4 sort of vaguely plausible models on the right-hand side. It's clear that the universe is not those 3 models and that it might be something like that model at bottom left. Well, how do we make that precise? Well, of course, we measure the correlation function and the power spectrum. Here's the redshift space correlation function for our galaxies. The blue dots are 2DF. The black dots are the Sloan early data release. You can see that the agreement at large scales is very good. But at small scales, there's a difference, and that's not an error. That's a genuine difference due to the fact that I already showed you that the red selected galaxies of the Sloan survey do indeed cluster differently on small scales than the blue selected galaxies of 2DF. So that's actually an interesting thing that I'll come back to later on. Here are the power spectra, the Fourier transform of the correlation function. Again, you're seeing the 2DF and in 2 different ways. Here's our team's calculation of the 2DF power spectrum. That's the diamonds there making almost continuous thick black band down there. And then there's an independent group also computed it, doing it a somewhat different way. They computed band power spectra, and they therefore have independent errors on these bluey-green points, which is not the case for the points here. And you can see again that the agreement is extremely good. We have clearly calculated the thing correctly, we know what we're measuring. The other dots here are from the reflex cluster survey, and of course the cluster power spectrum is higher than the galaxy power spectrum simply because clusters are more strongly biased. Survey window function, of course, is critical in determining these things. This is our determination of the final window function for the survey. This can be thought of as the point spread function in Fourier space, large-scale structure, so that we blur out wave numbers down in this regime here, but sharply resolve it on scales here. And you can see that in this range here from, say, 60 megaparsecs out to 600 megaparsecs or thereabout is the scale on which we actually can do large-scale structure work. What's the effect of the window function? Well, the main effect is simply to depress the true redshift space power spectrum. On the right here, we've got the solid line of the redshift space power spectrum of a lambda CDM model, an in-body model we just put in and then calculated the power spectrum for. The dots are what you would recover from the 2DF for that particular model, including the effect from the window function. Then, of course, the other thing to worry about is cosmic variance. Here are 22 different models. These are all lambda CDM models with plausible parameters. The individual thin lines here are the power spectra that you recover from each of those 22 models, and the solid line here is the mean power spectrum from that. So those are the sort of cosmic variance errors one could expect to get. Okay, the CDN power spectrum. Mostly I'll be showing it in terms of the dimensionless power spectrum here. So the power spectrum itself, simply the Fourier decomposition of the density field. The delta K squared there is the normal power spectrum. I'll normally be talking about the dimensionless power, which is just the logarithmic derivative of the fluctuations there. It's just K cubed times the power spectrum. And it has a nice property that it's more intuitive in the sense that on at small wave numbers, large scales, the power is actually lower, and at small wave numbers, small scales, the power is stronger, which is more what you actually think of as the fluctuation spectrum. This can be normalized on large scales by CMB, or on small scales by the clusters. But what we're effectively measuring when we look at the power spectrum is this overall shape parameter, the bend here, which depends on this gamma parameter, which is the first order, simply the product of the Hubble constant and the mean mass density, although it also depends slightly on the baryons. The effect of the baryons on the large-scale structure power spectrum of galaxies is very much less than it is for the CMB. For the CMB, it's a dominant effect. It's quite apparent. If you can measure the thing at all, you can see the baryon oscillations. For the large-scale structure, you first of all have to take out the overall shape of the curve I was showing you a moment ago in order to see the very much smaller-scale fluctuations that are occurring here. Those fluctuations are somewhat out of phase as well with the CMB fluctuations. Here's our determination of the power spectrum, now plotted in terms of the dimensionless power here. You can see that comparing it, first of all, to the dotted curves, which are baryon-free models, that the curvature parameter, omega mh, is somewhere in the range around about 0.2. You can also see that there are slight bumps and wiggles there, which give you some sort of hint that there may be the baryon oscillations in there somewhere. It's worth pointing out, of course, that on scales less than about here somewhere, a few tens of megaparsecs, we're being dominated by nonlinear effects, and so we ignore those regimes when we're doing fitting.
I'm sorry,
can
I
talk? Yeah, sure.
What are the going up
with them? In the dotted curves, you're going from omega h of 0.1, 1.5 to 0.25, 0.3. And then the same curves of solid lines with BBN fraction baryons added in. Yes, that's right. I don't know if it's as much as a factor of two, but it's something of that order. So if we take out an approximate mean curve, something with omega h, say 0.25 here, just divide through that just as a fiducial curve. This is what's left. The dotted lines there do indeed show some sort of bumps, wiggles. Scales less than about 0.015 in K, we've got errors that are too large due to cosmic variance. On scales bigger than 0.15 in K, so in the nonlinear small scale regime, we're actually throwing that data away too. So we're simply fitting to a single decade in wave number between here and here. The models, there's two models shown here. The models are separated in color. So purple's one model, blue's another. The blue curve is a low baryon model. The purple curve is some high baryon model. These are just not fits to the data. They're simply illustrative. The raw model is the dot dashed line, and then convolved with the power spectrum is the solid line here. So it's the solid lines that we're actually fitting to the data, and the parameters we're fitting are the overall shape parameter, omega mh, the baryon fraction, omega b on omega m, and we then also have to fit the Hubble constant, and then we marginalize over that when we're doing our fit. So here are the confidence limits that we get on those two things, the shape parameter and the baryon fraction. Our prior here is that the Hubble constant's 0.7 plus or minus 10%. And you can see that we get a banana-shaped curve here with two peaks. The higher peak here, our best fit, has omega mh of about 0.2 and a baryon fraction of 0.15. But it's only a bare 2 sigma detection here. This was the original analysis that we did with only about a half of our survey. It's been improved, as I'll show you in a moment. However, I'll just show you the comparison with various other determinations in this plane. The blue is the cluster baryon fraction, the yellow is CMB anisotropies, and the purple is Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And you can see that although we've got very large extended contours here, our peak is in good agreement with all these other determinations. However, we can do better than that. Here's a very early version of a final analysis. This is using the entire 221,000 galaxies. So it's doubling the area and improving the window function because our coverage is better. If we apply no constraint to n, to the power spectrum slope, then the initial slope rather, then the we get numbers that are virtually the same as before, and again, good agreement, although our curve is now separating out into two peaks, one at high and one at low baryon. But that high baryon peak is entirely because it allows peculiar values of the initial power spectrum slope, and if we require that n equals 1, or even approximately 1, then we narrow things down quite considerably. We're left with only the second lower peak here, but we still get consistent values for the shape parameter and for the baryon fraction, but we've increased our confidence in the baryon fraction to about a 3 sigma result.
Which slope is this here for the second
n equals 1?
No, for it to be present.
What is the n value? I don't know. I'd have to look it up for you, actually. Yeah. How does that compare with previous results? This is two results from the point source catalog redshift survey from the previous generation and from the early data release of the Sloan survey. You can see that the shape parameter is pretty well defined now. All three surveys are getting answers that are essentially identical, and it's just the error that's shrinking somewhat with time.
The scale is just omega h, or is it
omega h?
Correction?
No, it's just omega h. Well, for this, we don't need to know what the bias is yet.
Okay.
We're just fitting a gamma at this point, right, a shape parameter, and interpreting that as omega h. Yep. So it's only when you interpret it that you need to know the bias, yes? But I'll come back to that. Okay, so that's one way of getting at omega and omega h. Another way of getting at omega is through the redshift space distortions, looking at the fact that the redshifts that you actually measure are the sum of the true redshift, the Hubble redshift, and the peculiar velocity. And the peculiar velocities, of course, depend on the mass density through the beta parameter, which is the growth factor omega to the 0.6 divided by the bias parameter, where one's assuming linear bias between the galaxy distribution and the mass distribution. As a result, one gets these very characteristic spindle-shaped contours in the redshift space correlation function. So you've got two main effects occurring. Here's the redshift space correlation function as a function of separation on the sky in megaparsecs and separation along the line of sight. On small separations on the sky, things are typically in the nonlinear regime, they're virialized, and you get the finger of God stretching out along the line of sight. That gives you the axis of your spindle. And then on larger separations on the sky, you're seeing the coherent infall due to the linear regime. And so you get a flattening along the line of sight. And so you end up with those two effects, whereas if you were looking in the real space, of course, you'd simply see circular contours. Now, of course, the finger of God effect is something we need to account for in fitting for this. It's a nonlinear effect. It's not telling us about cosmology as such. It's the coherent infall, of course, that gives us the beta parameter. So we have two parameters here. The beta parameter, which is omega to the 0.6 on B, which is the coherent infall shape, and then a simple toy model approximation for the pairwise velocity dispersion on small scales. And if we fit those two things jointly, then we get very good fits. You can see the contours of the fit there overlaid on the colored, pseudo-color contours of the measured correlation function. We get very good agreement there with these sorts of parameters here. We get a beta value of around about 0.5, and that means, of course, that if B is somewhere near 1, that means omega of about 0.3. However, again, that was for a very early version of the data set. The later version of the data set has much less noise in it. This is, a preliminary reanalysis with the full data set. It gives us essentially the same numbers here, but the quality of the data and the signal to noise and the correlation function are much improved. So we've now got two different ways of measuring omega-dependent parameters, omega H or beta, omega 0.6 on B, but we need to get rid of the bias in order to be able to interpret that as the mass density. The way we've got two different ways of doing that. One is to combine 2DF with the CMB. Here we simply use the fact that the galaxy power spectrum is the linear bias B squared times the mass power spectrum. And we can get the mass power spectrum by simply linearly evolving the CMB power spectrum down to redshift zero, and then dividing that into the galaxy power spectrum gives us the bias parameter. So here we've got the galaxy sigma 8 at the mean redshift of the survey and the mean and the effective luminosity in the survey as a function of omega n. And here we've got the sigma 8 from CMB, also as a function of omega m, dividing those two things out, correcting for the fact that the mean luminosity of the survey is about twice the L star, and the mean redshift of the survey is effectively about 0.17 for this particular weighting of the data set. We end up with these constraints on the bias and omega n. We find, in fact, that the bias parameter for an L star galaxy at zero redshift is 0.96 plus or minus 0.08. Now we can come at that a second way, purely from within the 2DF survey itself without introducing any external data at all, by looking at the bias spectrum, which is the Fourier transform of the three-point correlation function. In the large-scale linear regime, if the initial density fluctuation for a Gaussian field, then we expect this to be identically zero. But what we're looking at really is the quasi-linear regime, where it's a measure of nonlinear structure. We assume a local but nonlinear bias, so we assume both a linear term and a quadratic term for the bias. This allows it to, in theory at least, mimic some aspects of the large-scale structure, for example, its skewness, but can't account for the detailed shape information, the fact that, gravity forms filaments and so on. And the shape of the bias spectrum, of course, depends on the value of the bias parameter. So we compute his example showing how we can actually recover this from mock catalogs. We input mock catalogs with different measured bias parameters. Here's a set of mock catalogs with a lambda CDM model with bias parameters around about 0.9 or so. This is the recovered bias parameter for these input bias parameters. There's another tau CDM model. And you can see that to some sort of precision here, perhaps to plus or minus 20%, we're able to recover the bias parameter. In fact, we don't compute the full bias spectrum, but simply a subset of it, which is found to be sensitive to the shape information that's of relevance. We actually only use a set of isosceles triangles over a small angular range. And we actually then compare that aspect of the bias function, the bias spectrum rather, to the fiducial prediction, which would have linear bias of unity and no quadratic bias. Dividing the data by that fiducial function gives us these dotted points here. You can see the effect of other assumptions about the bias parameters here. If you've got a bias parameter of 1 but no quadratic bias, you get this dashed curve here. Conversely, if one has a bias parameter of 1 but some quadratic bias as well, you get the dot dash curve at the top. In fact, the formal fit to this data says that there's negligible quadratic bias. We get B2 of minus 0.05 plus minus 0.08. And that our bias parameter, a linear bias parameter, again, when corrected back to zero redshift and to L star, gives us a bias parameter of about 0.92 plus or minus 0.11. Yes. Yeah, it's for lambda CDM cosmology, yeah. So if we combine these results for beta and for the bias parameter from here, we end up with a value for omega m of 0.27 plus or minus 0.06. So we know it to 20% precision purely from the results of the 2DF alone, without invoking CMB or anything else. Okay, what about the relation to CMB results? Well, one can clearly use this information to break some of the degeneracies that exist. For example, the large scale structure stuff only measures omega H, and only if the power spectrum index is known, whereas CMB, for example, has degeneracies of its own. And by combining these two, we can actually do much better. So we take those sets of data, and we then find that the contours in our parameter space for shrink from the contours you get from fitting the CMB alone very substantially when you go to fitting CMB plus 2DF. How well do we actually do in those numbers? Well, here's some results from the Staffio et al. Paper. You can see the numbers that we actually get there for different fits. This is for CMB alone. This is for CMB plus 2DF RS with and without tensor components. And then the fourth one is also including constraints from BBN. Just to pick out some highlight numbers from there so you don't have to read the whole table. Omega M 0.27 plus or minus 0.07. Omega lambda 0.73 plus or minus 0.04. Baryon fraction 17%. H naught 66. That's actually a constraint that's comparable to the HST key project number. And we get values for sigma 8 depending on the model. So this model and this model, 0.6 to 0.72. You can, of course, get better constraints if you're willing to make more assumptions. If you think that the it's a flat cosmology and you just fold that in as an assumption, then you get this improvement in the error bars. The blue is CMB alone. The red is CMB plus 2DF. Here are the numbers. Here's a for a CMB alone. And as you go to 2DF, you can see that the numbers don't change very much. The actual fitted values don't change a lot in most cases, but the errors have shrunk considerably. In particular, anything involving omega M, you're getting something like a factor of 2 or 3 improvement in the constraints that you get by folding in the large scale structure survey. So you can pick out your favorite numbers there and use those. One other thing that's worth noting is that we're, of course, assuming a flat universe. We're not putting in any priors at all, however. You can also see that if you look at the models with tensor component on the right there, that we actually get a preferred model which is scalar dominated and in fact consistent with no tensor component at all at about 1.5 sigma. Another constraint we get is on the neutrino mass. What we're effectively getting is an upper limit on the total mass of all neutrino species, and this comes of course from looking for the suppression of small-scale power that comes from neutrino-free streaming. Here are three different models which differ only in their neutrino mass. The models in fact normalize out here with sigma 8, but in fact physically it's more useful to renormalize them out here on large scales, and then note that the large neutrino mass models have suppressed small-scale power simply because the neutrinos have free-streamed out of the structures at an early stage and decreased the power, the mass concentrations in those small structures early in the history of the universe. This fit, in fact, suggests that at the 2 sigma confidence level, the 95% confidence level, we've got about 13% at most contribution from neutrinos to the total mass density, and that puts an upper limit on the mass of some of the mass of the neutrino species of about 1.8 eV. That's the curve shown over here. This is the omega MH, the shape parameter of the power spectrum, and this is the neutrino mass fraction. This is the limit that we get to sigma, and that was the best previous bound from the work.
Neutrino mass is so small that it doesn't make any difference whether it's one massive neutrino or all three with equal masses. Because the free streaming lines will be different in cases.
I don't think it would make any difference, no. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Just the neutrino mass, and then it only use the shape information and not the amplitude.
No, it's using the amplitude on small scales, effectively. I mean, it's a relative shape. Yeah, so it's shape information.
Yeah, but it has different slope as well.
That's
it's just the shape, right?
It's effectively it's effectively just the shape, yes. I think the fits here actually include the amplitude, but I don't think the constraint comes from the amplitude, it's purely from the shape. We also get constraints on the equation of state of the dark energy. I won't go into the background here. This is simply the constraints shown using 2DF and CMB in red, and then 2DF and CMB plus HST in green. And this is in the WH plane. You can see that the combined constraint on W, if we assume a flat universe, and this does assume a flat universe, is rather degenerate if you only use 2DF and CMB because of the H-naught dependence there. And so you need an extra constraint from HST value of H-naught in order to help remove that. And overall, you get a 2 sigma confidence limit that the mean value of effective value of W for the redshift range that we're looking at, which is around about 0.1, of course, is less than minus 0.52. The main contribution of the 2DF to this constraint is through its extra constraint on the mass distribution, the mass density.
And this is with the prior that W has to be negative
minus 1? This is, yes. The preferred value is, in fact, minus 1. The best value with that constraint is minus 1, in fact. So you're forced down to it, but we're not attempting to constrain lower numbers. Another fun thing that one can do is one can take the best fitting parameters that one obtains from the CMB and large-scale structure fits and then predict what the CMB power spectrum should actually look like. And with the uncertainties on the parameters we currently have, that's the sort of grey region in the upper diagram there, and that's worth comparing to the sort of error bars that are going to be coming out of MAP. And it's pretty clear that we should be able to test that pretty strongly with MAP because the error bars on MAP are so small. So that's quite a... The top one, the range here, is the range comes from the range of parameters in the fit. For the bottom one, it's exactly the same mean line, but with error bars as predicted for MAP. Another thing that's worth looking at is the variation with luminosity of the clustering strength, the bias. This is a plot showing the correlation length for galaxies with different absolute magnitudes. So this is effectively the bias as a function of luminosity. Here you can see the galaxies in red for the 2DF survey and various previous pieces of work. You can see that there is a strong effect that brighter galaxies are more strongly biased, have stronger clustering than the fainter galaxies. That's in pretty good agreement with semi-analytic models that you can dredge out of the literature. But it's also in good agreement, in fact, slightly better formal agreement, with a very simple linear relationship where the relative change in the bias parameter goes like 0.15, the relative change in the luminosity. Another thing one can do is one can compare the star-forming and non-star-forming galaxies, the actively star-forming and passive galaxies in our sample. Here's just the B minus R color distribution by taking the supercosmos scans of the R plates as well to get B minus R colors. And these are the active galaxies, blue here, and the passive red galaxies there. These are in pretty good accord, one-to-one, with the passive and active galaxies identified by principal component analysis of the spectra, which is effectively looking at the H-alpha equivalent widths as a measure of star formation. But by using the colours, we can actually extend this separation of passive and active galaxies out to higher redshifts, because the principal component analysis drops off about here, simply due to the fact that we can't track H-alpha further out in our spectra. Here then is the distribution of the non-star-forming galaxies in a 4-degree thick slice, and this is the distribution of the star-forming galaxies. If I just wobble between those, you can clearly see the different bias. So here's the power spectra for those two different samples. Passive galaxies have more power than the active galaxies, as you would expect. If one divides those both by a fiducial gamma equals 0.2 model, one can see that the two power spectra track each other quite well, and one can confirm that simply by dividing one by the other. It looks as if a constant relative bias of around about 1.4 would adequately explain the difference between the two power spectra.
So how do you
The characteristic luminosity of the passive galaxies is slightly brighter than that of the active galaxies. They've got different luminosity functions. So, I mean, it's not trivial to say that one's brighter or fainter than the other. The two distributions, of course, strongly overlap. The passive ones perhaps are marginally brighter. I can show you more detail of that later if you like, but there's not a big difference, is the answer. You can do the same analysis, or rather you can split the sample the same way and then do the redshift space distortion analysis. Here's the xi sigma pi diagrams, the correlation functions in redshift space for the passive galaxies here, the active galaxies there. You can see quite strongly that the finger of God effect is much stronger for the passive galaxies than for the active galaxies. You get beta parameters here. First of all, it should be noted that that of course translates into a higher pairwise velocity dispersion on small scales for the passive and the active galaxies. The beta parameters also differ in the way that you would expect, and for assuming the same omega, simply ratioing those two numbers would give you a relative bias of around about 1.2. So within the errors, and this is a fairly early version of this analysis, entirely consistent with the power spectrum analysis I showed you a moment ago. Okay, so just about the last thing. This is the most recent thing we're doing, which is to identify all the groups and clusters in the survey. We're actually using a friends of friends algorithm to identify as many groups and clusters as we can from the full 3D information available to us. And that's the diagram shown at right there, with the redder objects having larger velocity dispersions and the bluer, blacker objects. You can see the some preliminary distributions for things like, for example, the velocity dispersions of objects here. You can see the distribution here of the rich clusters, and then you can also see the fact that we're obviously incomplete for the very small groups.
So this is just using the redshift catalog?
Purely using the redshift catalog, yeah. So if you want to have a play with any of this data, it's available on the web, or at least the first 100,000 galaxies are currently available on the web. There you'll find photometric catalogs, spectroscopic catalogs, images, spectral types, and eventually we'll also have line indices and velocity dispersions for those objects we can measure them for. All of this stuff is readily available through an SQL database. You can simply query your favorite objects and then pull them up and examine the data directly, and then download it in ASCII format or as FITS files or in any other way that you see fit. The public release of the full and final 2DF database is currently slated for June 2003, although we're well ahead of schedule for that, actually, and it's possible that we may, in fact, release it sooner than that. So should see that coming to a website near you fairly soon. And otherwise, I think I'm done. Any questions?
The number you gave for the relative dispersion of the full sample, in that same line, you also have 8 different times of the sample. Is that the scale that you associate with the dispersion? Or is
no, that's the scale over which we actually fit xi sigma pi. So we ignore the very most inner parts of it, and then we try and fit just the regime from 8 megaparsecs, where things get too nonlinear to give you any handle on beta at all, out to 25 megaparsecs, where our signal-to-noise begins to drop off. So that's the range we're actually fitting over. So that's not an optimal way for fitting for the pairwise velocity dispersion, because our goal there really is to get the best possible handle on beta. Nonetheless, if you don't account for the pairwise velocity distribution, or if you put in, for example, the wrong form for that fall-off with scale, then you don't get a reliable answer for beta. We'd need to redo the analysis if you wanted to get the best possible measure for the pairwise velocity distribution.
In the literature, usually for the
That's right, it's done on much smaller scales, yeah. But here we were very much focused on getting beta, so you do it a different way. Nonetheless, it's also true that because it's an exponential tail off, although we're actually fitting on 8 to 25 megaparsec scales, that number probably does apply to much smaller scales, although maybe not optimally.
Passive and active galaxies, is the ratio consistent with the ratio of the
past? Yes, yeah, well, as I say, the raw number is 1.2 for the redshift space distortion relative bias and 1.4 for the power spectra. We haven't yet done the full error analysis, but I'd be amazed if that's more than one sigma different, to be honest. I know that we're measuring the bias to only 10% for the full sample, and when we split it into those two subgroups, it's got to be worse, it can't possibly be better, so they can't be more than joint errors of about one sigma apart. And as I say, it's a preliminary analysis anyway, it's still being refined.
For the cluster catalog, do you have any idea of what redshift would be?
We can go back and have a look, actually. I think it'll be, this is only plotted out to redshift 0.2, Certainly, I'd be very surprised if it was complete for anything other than the very richest clusters beyond 0.2, just because of the shape of our redshift distribution. But I would expect it's good to out to at least 0.15. Our median redshift is 0.11, so we certainly aren't losing very much out to 0.15.